Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. Excuse me. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about compliance to the Constitution. And we've been trying to really go back forward. So, Sean, I'm not sure if you remember, I was going to say or kind of provide a little clarity towards, you know, when we came back today. But do you remember what this old babbler said in his babbling?
We were talking about how they were arguing in apportionment, and then we got into how Washington treated his slaves, and you talked a little bit about Jefferson and the original draft of the Declaration.
Yeah, and I think that there was, so we were looking at, and let's just get back to where we were, and welcome back, Tammy. We were just reading Mr. Wilson and his less umbrage on the rule of representation, that, you know, they were at least, you're taking that path, and how he put the politically correct thing in there. So the monster that they dealt with in their time were the state governments. Those were the cabals. Now the cabals or the stage or corruption has really expanded, folks, into so many different things, from corporations, global corporations, any corporation that's operating outside of a single state and is bridging into other states under the auspices of other government other than the states that they're operating in. Like in the United States, the federal government is controlling the regulation of states operating in the United States, which is unconstitutional. But nevertheless, the point is that there are so many monsters, there are so many entities that are fighting us, that are contributing to our demise. And believe it or not, the ones that are contributing or have the greatest impact on us are those that are of the conservative nature. In other words, we are our own worst enemy. I can go into, you know, any group that is myopic, any group that is unwilling to put aside their differences with others and their self-interest. They're the monster. These are the problems here. Because all's we need to do is unite. And everybody goes, yes, let's go unite. And when I wrote my very first book, I was so naive to think that all the good Christian, religious, righteous, conservative patriots were just, all they needed to do was unite. That I had no clue how dark and devious the factions were within the ranks of the good, righteous, Christian patriots. And boy, did I get poked in the eye quickly. And boy, did I, you know, go get raked across, you know, the coals by the John Birchers. How dare you try to intermix and get the conventionites to work with the anti-conventionites? We're anti-conventionites, and we'll never work with those conventionites. I mean, that was pretty clear. And I go, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me, right? And no, as a matter of fact, when I moved up into the into the Spokane area, and I finally came, so I was very naive politically. I just want everybody to understand this. And this is actually in my second book to help clarify how stupid I was to think that us like-minded people could get along and unite. I mean, I was just delusional to think that we could, you know, because we all shared the same principles of repentance and forgiveness and all these good things of Christianity, that we could do this. No, are you kidding me? So I had to, you know, clarify some things. in my second book. I had to clarify, no, I am not calling for a constitutional convention. I realized, shoot, I had a great man as a father. My father was a very righteous man. He was a man that spent his time. His major was political science. His profession, he was a certified engineer. I mean, if you know what it takes to become a certified engineer, that takes a lot of education, and that's one of the most rigorous. I think that is a more difficult test than usually passing the bar or the med board, whatever, those types of things. So it's tough. And so my father, for his profession, was an engineer, so he liked solving problems, and he was passionate about political science and trying to understand why America was so screwed up. And so I remember as a child, while he was starting his political science endeavors, he was already doing engineering stuff. I mean, that's what he gravitated towards. But I remember when we took a trip down to California to see old friends when we moved out of California to Washington. And I was just 11 or 12, but I sat in my father's presence with his friends, just a bunch of men sitting in a room complaining about politics. I don't know if any of you have childhood memories of that, but I remember listening to them talking about, what was going on with the oil embargoes and, why this was happening. And the talk about, and I remember specifically about them talking about farmers actually taking their cattle, taking their sheep, taking their chickens out into the fields or into a big trench and culling them by burning them alive. Just killing them off. Because at this point in time, the federal government had seized control for the second time of setting prices to say, you cannot sell your chicken beyond this price. You cannot sell your cow, or your meat beyond this price. They set these ceilings so that, because at this point in time, the economy was just going crazy. And Congress gave Nixon the authority to do what FDR did, Roosevelt did. And so this was like, this real wake-up call. This was when we were just being taken off of the gold standard. I'm telling you that this was a point in time, there was a huge change in American politics, government, and so forth. And a lot of people point to this time as that was the time when we got off the gold standard, or that was the time when we brought Russia in as a most favored nation. We started actually basically subsidizing them as a communist nation to become powerful so that they could be a foreign enemy to us, which that makes a lot of sense, right? Yeah, let's take these people who are already our enemy and let's, help, develop their economy so that they can become, wealthier, so that they can afford to, create better weaponry to fight us, to kill us. That's a good idea, right? So anyway, so if you want to, just to give you a little glimpse of the inner sanctum of, GR's childhood growing up, the fact is that when my father and I, because by this point in time I was in the Marine Corps, a little bit later in the 70s I was in the Marine Corps, and my father said, you better make sure you understand that Constitution, you're taking an oath to it, blah, blah. I mean, he was, he did everything that you would expect a good father to do, to, hold you accountable and make sure you're pointing in the right direction. And he was a father to the end. I mean, that's a responsibility that people never shed. If you're a parent, you're always a parent until you die, because you still have that mantle, that responsibility of, guiding and assisting your children. Anyway, so we started talking, and as a matter of fact, in the early 80s, it really was getting just worse and worse because of what Carter was able to do. And so politically, my father was, and this is when I first read the Federalist Papers, because you could buy books on the Federalists, Anti-Federalists. And, we were actually having very deep conversations about what to do, what to do, what to do. at this point in time, it was like, I want to say 84, a movement had kind of already started, and actually Scalia, Anthony Scalia, had made a comment that, you know, it would not be a good idea to, I think, I'm pretty sure, as a matter of fact, I would ask either Sean and or Tammy to look it up, because I may be confused. Maybe Scalia was in favor of the Constitutional Convention movement at the time, but I think that he wasn't. And there was a lot of people that were just foaming at the mouth, oh, we need to do this. We need to do this. And so in examining this, because my father and I, you know, is this something that would be a viable thing? And when we looked at the purpose, when the, you know, going through the Federalist Papers, just because that's the only document we had. I didn't have the ratifications yet, ratification debates. But in looking at the Federalist Papers, there was, you know, it talked about the convention in Article 41, you know, Federalist Paper number 41, or not 49, I mean. And when you look at them talking about the Constitutional Convention and the purpose behind one, the purpose of having a convention means that there are problems with the Constitution that, you know, you've just got to get involved. I mean, you can't let these problems with the Constitution linger because the problems that they're inducing. And so you look and go, well, we came to the conclusion that the Constitution really wasn't the problem, that there was nothing really you could change about the Constitution that would fix the problems that we were dealing with. Now, I will tell you that, you know, I looked at, you know, like the drug laws. You know, the government needed to get out of drug laws. You know, certain things, a little, you know, in my paradigm. But I will tell you, I evolved and evolved a lot from that point to where, you know, when I retired from the Marine Corps and got into engineering myself and started, and not certified, just got into engineering. And started, you know, looking at this. By this point in time, my relationship with my father had really galvanized to a point that we would commonly pray and we would seek guidance as to, what do we need to do, Lord? I mean, it's only getting worse. This is really getting bad. And I mean, I'll just say this to just kind of wrap up. My father, his vision of the magnitude of the direction of government and so forth, when I was still a child, I hadn't graduated from high school yet, my father felt so moved that he wanted to actually buy property somewhere either in northern Canada or up in Alaska to get away from government, because he saw the threats of government were that real. He wasn't a conspiracy theorist. I'm going to tell you, my father was not a conspiracy theorist. But he realized that government was assuming powers that weren't delegated, and the way they were executing these powers was warfare-like, i.e. when we looked at what they did with the oil embargo and all these other problems. At that point in time is when my father was going, you know what, we got to prepare to get away from this and create the, you know, the compound, right? So I'm just sharing this with you so that you can kind of see that I just didn't casually walk along in life and all of a sudden become, you know, this passionate person about the Constitution. I will say that my father's heavy hand and his heavy influence in my life, it was more heavy influence than hand, by all means. You know, that influence really helped me start seeing things that, you know, he was really impressing upon me. And it got to a point when, right before he passed away, I finally came up with this concept of Republic Review and so forth. And I don't know if anybody, if any of you has ever had the affirmation that you've really made your parents proud, or your father proud. I will say that really happened to me, because when I went to visit him when he was in hospice, getting, you know, being prepared to die, I told him what needed to be done, what we were doing, and so forth. And he was so moved that my mother at the end of the day, when he was finally sleeping again, she says, I've not seen him that animated for months. He's never exerted that kind of energy to where he got up out of his chair and he grabbed Aristotle and Plato's books and, you know, other things that he was just so moved to share things with me because he wanted to make sure don't forget to do this because I told him I was going to write a book about this concept of Republic Review. And it was very humbling to see my father tell my mom to call all of these people. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman who was running for governor, Dino Rossi. He wanted Dino Rossi to come over and hear what I had to say. He wanted all these people. He was just so moved. And I go, wow, I mean, this is, it made me feel uncomfortable that I had made this measure of a leap that my father felt so strongly about what I was doing. I don't know if that I can explain that better, but it just really made me feel uncomfortable. I mean, I was so happy that he was, you know, that I was right, or, you know, that he saw that. But it, anyway, he actually later on.
Then comes along the pressure.
Well, and the fact is, you know, he passed. And so that's one of the reasons why, when you actually look at the credits for my first book, I used, you know, his initials and name as co-author because he had that kind of impact on me. And I tried to do that with my second book, and ironically, the Patent and Copyright Office of the, you know, U.S. Patent Office wouldn't let me do it the second time. And I go, well, what do you mean? I've got a patent already with them. And they go, well, you can't do that unless he's actually, you know, living and, you know, that's his material. And it sounds like this is just a posthumous thing. You can do a forward, but you can't put his name. And I go, I already got it. You gave it to me once.
Wow.
And anyways, and I, you know what? I didn't want to basically, you know, pound the bush too hard because I figured, what are you talking about? We actually did this. They would go and rip it up and say, you can't do that. So I got one book published with his name on it. But the point is that as I moved forward, this is, you know, I was very naive on what I was dealing with in the ranks. My father had been involved in the party. He actually, believe it or not, was involved, met Meckler, knew Meckler, and wasn't involved with the Convention of States, but was very interested in looking at what Meckler was trying to do. This was post, as Meckler was selling it more and more, even though we'd come to the conclusion that we didn't need it. Needless to say, you know, through my years, it's been, you know, a very humbling process because if you really want to solve problems and you make that appeal to heaven, I will tell you, folks, the scriptures, they do not disappoint. When it says, knock and it shall be opened unto you, ask and ye shall find, if you're really sincere and you prove your sincerity in doing something, you will get what you need. Because it's happened. It's happened in my life. And so the point is that, you know, we're today in such a divided state that old adage, united we stand, divided we fall, is ringing so loud that we can't hear ourselves think. Because so many people have bought into, well, it's all about the guns, we got to save our rights, and it's all about the Second Amendment, the NRA, what have you, or the Convention of States, or what have you. These are all myopic organizations, but technically the Convention of States basically asserts themselves as the only process of holding government accountable, which is an outright lie. I go through this all the time. The point is that, folks, if you really care, you've got to get involved, and we got to turn our backs on these deceiving, deceitful institutions that do not care whether we solve this problem. They only care about maintaining, you know, the retirement plans for those who carried the baton before them, you know, and maintaining the finances they need, because if we solve the problem, there are going to be people that they will not be able to pay their retirement for. And so some people may actually look at you know, this solution and go, that's great, that's great. But we can't do this because it would financially ruin us. Well, that's a good problem. I think that's a better problem to have than be ruined by the hands of the globalists.
Yeah.
And what's to say that when the globalists take over, they'll allow you to exist and you'll be able to maintain your retirement program in the second place, right? Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true. That's a good point.
So, you know, sometimes you just have to piss or get off the pot. There's another term that says it's either time to fish or cut bait. And at this point in time, if we're not fishing, you're just going to be overrun by all the bait you've been cutting. We need to fish. We need to act. We need to interpose. We need to unite. And the fact that there's these institutions and organizations out there that are holding us back, you folks, you have no idea how frustrated I am. I lose sleep over this. I'm seething. And I know that Sean and Tammy have, you know, dealt with, you know, my wringing of my hands and and they share the same frustrations. We need your help. This is truly, this whole first part of this show is really an appeal that if you're engaged in a myopic organization, please wake up. Please look at what they're doing and not what they're doing and say, you know what? You're a part of the problem. You are a part of the problem. And it really comes down to the simplicity that you cannot be a part of the problem and a part of the solution. The only way that we're going to solve this is we have to be a part of the solution. We have to put away, literally put all of our differences aside. We have to put aside our self-interests. You know, if you expect to get paid to do this, then that's a part of the problem right there. I believe that the Lord will bless those who actually and vigorously get engaged. Somehow, some way, don't worry about it. He will make things happen. I understand that we live in a complicated time of the economy is making money and so forth. It's not like it's good enough just to grow your own food because you own your land. We're not there. We've basically created a system that puts us into serfdom. Anyway, we need your help. And so with that, what we need to do is start off with Mr. King, like we were saying. And Tammy, I know we've got about a minute and a half, but let's go ahead and get this started. And I'll just interrupt you how far you get. But go ahead. Let's start this off.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Although this amendment varies the aspects somewhat, he had still two powerful objections against tying down the legislature to the rule of numbers. One, they were at this time an uncertain index of the relative wealth of the state. Two, if they were a just index at this time, if they were a just index at this time, it cannot be supposed always to continue so. He was far from wishing to retain any unjust advantage whatever in one part of the republic. If justice was not the basis of the connection, it could not be of long duration. He must be short-sighted indeed, who does not foresee that whenever the southern states shall be more numerous than the northern, they can and will hold a language that will awe them into justice. If they threaten to separate now in case injury shall be done them, will their threats be less urgent or effectual when force shall back their demands? Even in that intervening period, there will no point of time at which they will not be able to say, do us justice or we will separate.
Okay, so right there, that's a good spot. That right there is a good spot. And actually, this kind of goes to what Sean and I were talking about in a couple of the previous episodes where we weren't blessed with your presence. So when we come back from this pending break, because, folks, it's coming, and here's the music right there. So when we come back from this break, we will kind of revisit these things that we've covered already, because here he's pointing out what I think is, you know, some very interesting points that kind of tie this to this, the real problem this whole paradigm separation between slavery and not. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so before you read on, let me just kind of tie things here, because just because the break gives us the allowance to do this. We had been reading some pernicious perspectives that, you know, how they were just being really callous in some respects regarding, you know, these people as property, not giving them representation, so forth. And actually, Sean literally, if you remember, called them out as being hypocrites and just how evident this really is. So what he's really saying, what Mr. King is saying here, is kind of repeating Sean's sentiments. And he talks about, you know, this whole point. And as a matter of fact, first off, we talked about how some people really thought they had a good handle on the population and the migration trends, that, you know, Georgia was going to be a very heavily populated state soon. And I mean, that's what Mr. Sherman said. And I go, obviously they didn't know anything, because it was just conjecture. But here Mr. King is actually stating something that is in a different vein. I mean, he's actually stating that, hey, we don't know. Because right there, when you read this out of the numbers, the first point that he makes, they were at this time uncertain index of the relative wealth of the states. In other words, they had no idea this disparity in wealth between the states, because they've never done this. They weren't going down that path with the Continental Congress. Getting that type of data to understand was one of those things that go, huh, you know, we're making conjecture here. We really don't know how wealthy they are. In other words, the South could be telling us that they're so rich they can pay for the war, but when we got to go to war, maybe they can't pay for it. Who knows? We've got to, you know, we need to be talking about facts. The next thing he says, if they were a just, in other words, if there was justice within this index at this time, it cannot be supposed always to continue so. In other words, this index of using property, slaves, as a just thing to do. He says it may be just at this point in time, but moving forward, it may not be so. Things may change. We actually may change the sentiments like we already have. Because Massachusetts really hated the heathen states of slavery. I mean, it was just in John Adams' letters and so forth, how he just talked derogatory towards the southern states, and he called them out. John Adams was such a pompous man, he would call out slave owners to their face. How can you do that? And I think, you know, in some ways, Sean, wouldn't you laud that? Wouldn't you say, well, that's great. I mean, that's what we should do.
Absolutely.
Okay. See? We need to be calling people out. Okay, then he also goes, if justice was not the basis, because Mr. King is basically pointing that as we move forward, justice, as the world perceives how we treat each other, is not the basis of the union, then this connection cannot be for a long period of time. So in a way, he's kind of making a prophetic, you know, prediction that, you know, we've got problems, we need to address these things, and we need to correct this so that we can move forward and prevail over time. Okay? And so go ahead and finish that last sentence or what do you have left. He urged the necessity. Thank you.
Okay. He urged the necessity of placing confidence to a certain degree in every government and did not conceive that the proposed confidence as to a periodical readjustment of the representation exceeded that degree.
Okay, so now the North had spoken, kind of poked some people's, or, you know, maybe hurt some feelings or something like that. But Mr. Pinckney gets up and broaches Mr. Randolph's motion. Because, again, it was Mr. Randolph that pointed out, well, let's just, for expediency purposes, let's just refer to the Articles of Confederation and Continental Congress, how they broke down the ratio, however they did it, we'll just do that. We'll just go down that path. So Mr. Pinckney saw that as a good positive sign, giving them something. The South wanted one for one. They wanted full apportionment for every slave. But at this point, they were willing to concede three-fifths. So go ahead and read Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina, Sean. Thanks.
Mr. Pinckney moved to amend Mr. Randolph's motion so as to make, quote, blacks equal to whites in the ratio of representation, end quote. This, he urged, was nothing more than justice. The blacks are the laborers, the peasants of the southern states. They are as productive of pecuniary resources as those of the northern states. They add equally to the wealth, and considering money as the sinew of war to the strength of the nation, it will also be politic with regard to the northern states, as taxation is to keep pace with representation.
Okay, so I undergeneralized because obviously he wasn't happy with the three-fifths. Ultimately, they have to concede because the northern states moving forward, and like I said, this was one of the two, I've said this. Slavery and property was one of the key, most contended issues along with state sovereignty. This is why these two issues created constitutional amendment protections in Article 5. That's how important these two issues were. So, go ahead, Tammy, and let's read Mr. Pinckney's South Carolina. This is General Pinckney, not Mr. Pinckney. Go ahead.
General Pinckney moves to insert 6 years instead of two as the period computing from first meeting of the year legislature within the first census should be taken. On this question for inserting six instead of two in the proposition of Mr. Wilson, it passed in the affirmative.
Okay, so the Y-E means the. It's short. It's shorthand for the, and as Sean aptly pointed out, it's
first
basically like
of the legislature.
Meaning of, yeah, right. So, how is three characters any shorter than three characters? I mean, how's that shorthand? Anyway.
If you're writing it, I guess.
Yeah. So you can look at the votes, and so on the question for filling the blank for the periodical census with 20 years, it passed in the negative. In other words, that was maybe too long or what have you. On a question for 10 years, it passed affirmative. In other words, they thought that 20 years was too long, probably 15 too long. Let's do it every 10 years. And why did they want to basically do the census every 10 years? Because if they grew more, then they would gain more representation. If you really think about it, one of the things of the competition in the states would be immigration. In other words, the state that could appeal more people to come and immigrate to them, then they would have the advantage. Now, the South
didn't think about the consequences of slavery as Europe was becoming more and more disdainful towards slavery, just like the North was. The abolition movement, you know, was alive and well long before the Revolutionary War. As a matter of fact, well prior to the Revolutionary War, and I think it goes back to maybe even Sir Isaac Newton's time of the 1600s, when the king or the monarch of France basically banned slavery in France. They still maintained slaves in the colonies, but they started basically trying to clean their act up and being one of the first. Well, the Dutch states and those types of states didn't have it, but those states that did have it, France was one of the leading states in moving away from slavery. So that said, as we kind of look at, you know, these states, they knew that their immigration was how they were going to grow their economy, how they would grow more influence in the government if they grew faster than the other states. Well, everybody thought that they had a pretty good offering for people to come into their state. Well, technically, on the slave states, they only cared about bringing in more slaves. And they were getting a diminished representation, or that diminished ratio of 3/5, where everybody that was coming in to work the land or what have you in the northern states, I mean, that was a full apportionment. And actually, when you look at the census, because I think I have a document that covers the different census, you know, this year to this year to this year, you'll actually find that the slave states weren't growing as fast. And that goes down to the point that, you know, when the land is being used for agriculture, there's not a lot of place for factories and industry and those types of things to get rooted and to, you know, to expand and grow, because where are you going to get your employees if everybody around you is working on plantations? How is a factory going to become successful? Ah, yeah. So it wasn't until the end of slavery when all of a sudden the South got broke open wide with the ability to move industry and factories into the South. And this is what caused what we call the Rust Belt. The Rust Belt is where the factories were built in the early age of our government up in the northeastern quadrant, or the northeastern area of the United States, down into Pennsylvania and so forth. And so as the labor was more attractive after the Civil War, factories were very happy. These corporations were very happy to pack up and go down south and start hiring people because they just needed basic labor in a lot of ways. So in other words, they didn't need, you know, the skill. They could train their people. They could train people to get the job done so that they could do it at a cheaper price because labor was much cheaper. Why? Because after slavery, there was a lot of people that didn't want to go back into that employment. So they were looking for work, and a perfect idea. Hey, let's bring a factory down there and give them jobs. And so anyway, again, this goes back to business decisions. What's good business decisions isn't necessarily good decisions. But anyway, let's go to Mr. Jerry or Gary of Massachusetts down a little further. So that would be Sean.
Mr. Gary urged that the principle of it could not be carried into execution as the states were not to be taxed as states. With regard to taxes in imports, he conceived they would be more productive where there were no slaves than where there were, the consumption being greater.
So, Tammy, with Mr. Ellsworth in Connecticut, go ahead.
Mr. Ellsworth, in case of a poll tax, there would be no difficulty, but there would probably be none. The sum allotted to a state may be levied without difficulty according to the plan used by the state in raising its own supplies. On the question, on the whole proposition, as proportioning representation to direct taxation and both to the white and 3/5 of black inhabitants and requiring a census within 6 years and within every 10 years afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did it pass? Massachusetts couldn't vote because they were divided. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, no. Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. North Carolina, yes. South Carolina divided, and Georgia, yes. So it passed. There you go. And so now, as we, you know, move down further into the convention, we can go down to, let me see here, the admission of new states on page 178. And this is being started off with Mr. Gary of Massachusetts. I'm not sure. Do you see that where we're at the bottom of 178?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So
I have a question about the issue before we move on to the next subject. When, if they give the apportionment and representation to the states according to whichever method they did with the three-fifths compromise.
Right.
If the black people couldn't vote, then that would mean that there would be a far less, there'd be equal representation that's under the influence of far less people. Like in the states where they didn't have slavery, people voted for their representatives, and just about the whole population that was able to vote would vote. Where in the South, only seems like only the slaveholders would be voting, since there wasn't a lot of free white population in those areas because they didn't have industry or whatever, then you would have a cabal of slave plantation owners that would be in control of that representation.
Yeah, okay, so
instead of the people at large.
Okay, so when it came down to voting, they did talk about, you know, kind of regulating who could vote and who couldn't vote. You had to be a landholder. I mean, this was a part of the Northwest Ordinance as well, where there were these requirements of what it took to be able to vote. And back in those days, how hard was it to become a landholder?
Well, imagine it wouldn't be that hard. I mean, it seems like they were, like, granting land to people.
Left and right. As a matter of fact, it only
homesteading and such.
$1.25 an acre. And so people with money in their pocket could easily go and buy, you know, with a life savings of, you know, $50, would be able to buy themselves 40-some-odd acres. I mean, plenty of land to be able to make them a full freeholder. And so the requirements that were levied by the states were different. Some wanted 25 acres. Some just wanted to be, you had to just be a freeholder. So the states set that up. And again, as we talked about why the blacks were being denied voting as we started going into the 1800s, because they started recognizing voter blocks and how blacks were more predominantly voting in contrary to what the political machine of New York wanted. They said, hey, these guys are getting rid of our Federalists and taking away our control. That's not a good thing. And so it took a little while, but eventually they systemically removed blacks from being able to vote in New York. So there's all these little factors, but bottom line, the one thing that they made sure that was a standard almost in every state was a poll tax. Just because you were a landholder doesn't mean you would vote. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people didn't vote because they didn't want to pay the tax. They didn't care because the federal government, they didn't see the federal government as that integral in their everyday life. They weren't producing anything that would create their need. You know, it took a while for people to start realizing as the federal government became growing and growing and assuming more and more powers, or basically handing out money in its benevolence, all of which were all unconstitutional. More and more people started getting more engaged and getting involved in supporting, you know, the voting and the government system. But in the very beginning, I think if you really look at the elections, there wasn't a lot. I mean, people would rather just keep their money because what's the difference if I vote? How would it change my life that much? Government wasn't doing that much in their lives. It wasn't that big of an impact. So a poll tax wasn't insidious. It was just a way for the states to basically make a little bit of money to cover the cost of the election and some. for the most part. So in other words, if we're going to provide a service, we're going to tax for that service. There you go. And that's what they did. But the federal government was not involved in the election process until the amendments for guaranteeing suffrage for purposes of race, for purposes of sex, for purposes of poll tax, or getting rid of poll tax, and then age. That's the only thing the federal government has regarding the election or vote, the voters. When it comes to the elections themselves, they did set, I mean, the federal government created a unified election every 4 years for the president because there was a problem with the Western states participating in the election process. This was so far back that the Western states were kind of bringing up the fact that, hey, because of the way you do the election and because you let everybody know who's voting, you know, the fact that we're not getting a poll tax because people aren't going to come to the polls because the election is already over because the news is telling us who won. That the voters don't go to the polls in California, Oregon, Washington, the extreme West Coast. The elections were already done. They already called the election for this president and for these people and so forth. The only reason people were still voting was because they were still interested in getting the representation, that type of stuff, but it was affecting their numbers. So what happened was Congress basically created a national law of elections, that election would be done on the same day, one day, and keep this in mind. This is federal law, and this is within the Constitution. The Congress may, you know, call forth the elections from the day, time, and manner. Those three things, right? So they're granted this power to be able to create a law and regulate the election for the day, time, and manner. So they did that so that they would keep states from having different elections and ensuring that all of the states benefited from participating in the process. I think they also started suppressing that they, you know, didn't want the news or anybody to cover it because, and actually everybody gained because it was a good business decision. If you don't call the election until after the West Coast polls are done, then, you know, there's more people that are going to be tuning in and hanging by a thread. So this became big business opportunities for both journalism and all sorts of people were benefiting from this. So by doing that this way, they made this one change in establishing the time, place, and manner. So the federal government dictated that on one day and one day alone, and I think it was the first Tuesday of the month, and the manner would be by paper ballot, precinct, what have you. The federal government never, in the time, place, and manner, I don't think they ever changed that. And the states were the ones that were changing. But the reality is the federal government could easily, during Biden and other administrations, could easily have invoked these bad voting measures. And even Trump got played on that in 2020, 2019. So I'm here to say that when we kind of look, do we want the federal government to do this? There are reasons for it, and we have this history, and this is what we have. But they don't even abide by that, because how many states are actually running their election weeks ahead of time? Well, hold on here. The federal law is the election is to be done on this day. How are these states getting away with bypassing the law?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah,
that is a good question.
Okay. All right, so
about to pay the piper, I have a feeling.
Yeah. Well, bottom line is, because we allow them to do that, the Democrats realize that if they can extend the election and the administrations don't go after them, the court systems don't go after them, because they know that the longer you run the election, the better chance of having control over it. In other words, influencing the outcome. Because the longer the election is open, the better chance there is for voter fraud, election fraud, and those types of things. Keep it short, keep it quick, and then you got a very tight window for them to have to be able to execute. people, you know, for 2-3 weeks, shoot, you know, everybody could get distracted. You know, hey, there was a fire over in this part of town, and nobody realized that a bunch of boxes with ballots just showed up at a couple of the polls. Whew. Because nobody was paying attention. If it's all done on one day, everybody's watching. So,
water pipe burst or something like that.
There you go. Right. There you go. So anyway, all right. So back to the admission. Let's go ahead and dive into this. Okay? Thanks.
Okay. Admission of new states. Finding that the loss of the question had proceeded from an objection with some to the proposed assessment of direct taxes on the inhabitants of the state, which might restrain the legislature to a poll tax, moved his proposition again, but so varied as to authorize the assessment on the states, which would leave the mode to the legislature. At this caret, insert the words interlined. This is a quote that from the first meeting of the legislature of the U.S. until a census shall be taken, all monies for supplying the public treasury by direct taxation shall be raised from the said several states according to the number of the representatives respectively in the first branch. Close quote. On this very question, it passed in the affirmative. So on the motion of Mr. Randolph, the vote of Saturday last authorizing the legislature to adjust from time to time the representation upon the principles of wealth and numbers of inhabitants was reconsidered by common consent in order to strike out wealth and adjust the resolution to that requiring periodical revisions according to the number of whites and 3/5 of the blacks. The motion was in the words following, but as to the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, that the legislature of the U.S. be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives, and in case any of the states shall hereafter be divided, or any two or more states united, or new states created within the limits of the U.S., the legislature of the U.S. shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter mentioned.
Okay, so now we're looking at how this paradigm is, you know, kind of getting entwined of admitting states into the Union, the possibility of slavery, and all of this. So these, I'm telling you that even though it didn't seem like admitting new states was a big deal, it actually was a pretty big deal. Because it all played in what property value, it all played in taxation, apportionment, all these little things that they've been struggling through over the course of now, mid-July, it's been about 2 months now. And they were, you know, having a hard time closing the deal. So, and that's because they started realizing the magnification, all of the interplay and the magnitude that it played to move it one direction or the other, whether the states were going to maintain their sovereignty or whether the states were going to be able to maintain slavery, so forth and so on. And these key issues that they were divided on, I can just say this, it was maintained throughout the whole time. I'm G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.